So we took a look at the sun. I think probably what we'll do is we'll definitely look at the Father, whether or not we get to the older son or not today, we'll see. But anyway, so the sun was who we were, who we are, and what we should do. We take a look at the Father. There's just a few things that I pulled out. I mean, it's not comprehensive, but there are a few attributes that I wanted to kind of drill down on as far as how the Father responded. So this is who God is and what we should seek to be like in terms of our interaction, especially with the foolish and the rebels. I think the best way, or one of the big words in terms of attributes of the Father, would be his meekness. You think about the fact that you have this self-absorbed, entitled, abrasive kid comes and demands, divide the property between us. You know, give me my share. Give it to me now. I don't know about you, but my response would have been, yeah, that's hilarious. No. But that's not his response. I mean, you think about when I started to think through and look and just thoughtfully consider the Father's response and how I would respond, his response is what? He divided the property between them. He didn't argue with the boy. He didn't fight him. He didn't try to stop him. Even if it was a surprise to his father, which it probably wasn't, his response, the father's response, was not to meet stubbornness with stubbornness or might with might. And immediately how convicting this was to me because of how I typically respond to these sort of things in my life. Romans 12:18 says, if possible, so far as it depends on you, be at peace with all men. He did not make it hard or fight the boy when he asked for what was his. And believe me, not me, and I don't think anyone else in here would have held it against the Father if he had attempted to make the inevitable as difficult as possible. In an attempt to delay the boy, or in a punitive or desperate way, try to stop what was happening. We wouldn't help. I mean, we all probably would have done something similar in terms of figure out ways to delay it, or figure out ways to make it hard, or figure out ways to kind of turn the screws on the boy as he left. The Father doesn't do any of these things. It's rather shocking. He didn't attempt to manipulate or coerce the boy into staying. And so the point of application for me immediately was, we should never respond in kind to the rebellious and the lost. Just as they are simply acting out of their true nature, we as believers should act out of our true nature and our heart toward them. As a believer, we are called to meet anger with control, violence with peace, bitterness with kindness, and hatred with love. The example of Christ's silent suffering as he was abused by his own creations, the very beings that depended on his sovereign will to live, were fearlessly and mercilessly attacking and taunting him. And he did nothing in return except ask God for their forgiveness and die so that there was the possibility that their sins might be covered by the blood that they were shedding. That's the example of God. That's the example of Christ. That's the example of the Father in this. That he meets their railing and the railing against the foolishness and the anger and hatred of the rebel with meekness and love and sacrifice and a complete lack of self-interest. There's no such thing in going too far in repaying evil with good. If Christ goes to the point where he dies for the very creatures that he created, and they're the ones that put him to death, we don't have a limit. There's no limit set on that we should ever repay evil with good. The meekness of the Father. And then the question I began to ask myself is, So why did he let his son go? If he does, he does this, and we see this, and we see the meekness in this, because he definitely had the means and the ability to be able to make it difficult or just say no to the kid and just send him on his way. Why did the father let the son go? It could be argued that he enabled his son to go do what he did. I mean, there's a very real way where you can look at the situation and say, the father is responsible for the boy's reckless living because he gave him everything the boy needed to go do that. That the father is culpable in this situation because he's the one that gave him the resources to go live the reckless wild life of abandonment. Why did the father let his son go? I'll tell you why. The father was wise. Proverbs 9, 7, and 8. Whoever corrects a scoffer gets himself abuse, and he who reproves a wicked man incurs injury. Do not reprove a scoffer, or he will hate you. Reprove a wise man, and he will love you. Proverbs 15, 12. A scoffer does not like to be reproved. He will not go to the wise. So why did the father let the son go? Because he knew who the son was, and he was wise enough to understand that trying to interact with the son on that level was unwise, was going to be unfruitful and unproductive. But still, he let him go. He knew the father knows what's going to become of the situation. We talked about that earlier. Why does the father let the son go? Because he understood he was wise, and he understood God's sovereignty. Jeremiah 10:23, I know, O Lord, that the way of man is not in himself, that it is not in man who walks to direct his steps. The Father knew who was in control of every minute detail of every situation that he was facing. He understood God's sovereignty. And the final reason, The final reason that the father was able to let his son go was that his allegiance was to God and not his son. Luke 14, 25 through 27. This is the chapter before this parable. Now great crowds accompanied him, and he turned and said to them, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Whoever does not bear his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. Verse 33, therefore, any one of you who does not renounce all that he has cannot be my disciple. His allegiance was to God and not to his son. He could not compromise his convictions to accommodate his son. They both clearly understood that. The son would have gladly stayed and lived life how he wanted to had it been possible in the father's house. Would he not have? He's not interested in anything other than doing what he wants to do. And what the son understood was that the father was not able to allow that to go on in his house, and that the only way for him to do that was to remove himself from his authority. The dad clearly had expectations and guidelines for his son that were to be followed. You see that in verse 29, where what does the older brother say? I did everything you ever told me to. I followed all your rules, Dad. I've done it all. It wasn't that the father was willy-nilly about it, or he didn't care about his son, and it wasn't that the father somehow was just allowing his son to go do these things. The father was more concerned about what he believed was right before God and was willing to allow his son to be exposed even to possible death and the destruction of his life because he knew that's what was right. And that he could not tolerate it and facilitate it in any way in his own home. And so for me, it became very clear what my application was, and I think it's for all of us in different ways, but what is your but that? Anything but that. Because for most of us, when you have kids, you realize right away that you can't explain it until you have them, what it means to protect them and love them and how much they mean to you and how much time and effort and energy you pour into them. But for us, most parents, it's easy for the children to become that. Those things that are out of order in our priority structure, which means we're likely making unwise or unbiblical decisions in order to keep them. Relationships, pet sins, freedoms. What is our but that we're willing to hold on to, even in the face of biblical wisdom to the otherwise or biblical commands to the otherwise? That we're willing to prioritize above our relationship with Christ Himself and His body. Luke 12, 49 through 53. And I think this is important because many times we want to preserve those relationships in hopes that somehow we can help or somehow we can keep that connection close, or maybe there's a way if we preserve the relationship that everything will be okay or I'll get a chance later on. Listen to Luke 12:49 in light of this. I came to cast fire on the earth, and I would that it were already kindled. I have a baptism to be baptized with, and now, and how great is my distress until it is accomplished. Do you think that I have come to give peace on earth? No, I tell you, but rather division. For from now on in one house there will be five divided, three against two, and two against three. There will be divided father against son, and son against father, and mother against daughter, and daughter against mother, and mother-in-law against daughter-in-law, and daughter-in-law against mother-in-law. I came to cast fire on the earth. I came to bring the sword and not peace on earth. Have I really counted the cost to the point where I'm willing to expose my child or whatever it is that but that to grave mortal danger to maintain a clear conscience? That's what the Father was willing to do in the situation. It's almost mind-boggling. How settled am I in what I believe? Am I settled enough to make such a heavy and consequence-filled decision? I'm literally right now asking myself those questions. We should be asking ourselves those questions. And we should be encouraging one another to be prepared for this reality. And we should rally around and support those who we know are being called to make those decisions right now and hold them up to encourage one another, to build one another up, because it is hard and it is counter to everything that's in our human flesh. He was meek and he was selfless. How do we know he was selfless? He had compassion on the Son. He ran to the Son. He embraced him and he kissed him. What a beautiful picture. Probably the most poignant part of the whole passage, really, or the parable. When you read it, you just see the beauty of the Son coming back and the Father running to Him. He was so selfless, the Father never allowed the Son's actions to become personal. Like we talked about earlier, not allowing someone to let you down, or to think that somehow they can't let you down or they can't act that way. They absolutely can and probably will, especially if they're the lost. But the Father never allowed His Son's actions to become personal. He clearly understood the boy had acted based on his nature. He didn't hold it against him. Again, how far from my reality would that be? Just like when the boy would have come, I'd have said, that's funny, no. When the boy came back, I'd have been, well, it's about dang time. You know, the shack's there out back. You can start plowing the field, and maybe I'll feed you tomorrow. No. This Father, He remained focused on the well-being of His Son and not His own personal well-being or reputation. I think this is important. It wasn't simply His well-being. The Father wasn't concerned about His reputation either. He didn't see the pain and suffering that He had endured as worth holding that against His Son. It was painful for the Father, no doubt. How do you know that? Look at the emotion that's involved in the reunion. It crushed the Father. It tore Him up. He was looking. The boy is way far away when he sees him. The Father was constantly looking and waiting for the child. But He didn't hold it against him. Instead of being concerned with making sure that our needs and desires are met, like the Father, we should be postured in such a way that we are looking for and ready to meet the needs of others as soon as they appear. And this requires us to be willing to be inconvenienced and taken advantage of. I mean, it's curious to me. The Father runs to the Son. He's got no clue. I mean, he doesn't know. I mean, there's a part of it where you would probably assume that something has happened to the boys coming home, but the father has no idea what's happened in the boy's heart. The father has no idea what's going on in his mind. The father has no idea what he's going to say. He could have been that boy could have come back and started to manipulate and start the process all over. The father didn't care. He was willing to be inconvenienced and taken advantage of. He was ready to embrace as soon as the opportunity presented itself. And I would just encourage us that we cannot care for ourselves and others at the same time. They're mutually exclusive. If we are going to say that we're going to love others, that automatically excludes our ability to love ourselves or take care of ourselves. And that's okay, because here's the beautiful thing about what God has promised us. What has God promised? He will never leave us nor forsake us. All our needs will be met. He loves us perfectly. We don't have to take care of ourselves, because God has already done it. Our job is simply to go and love others and to care for others. It's my job, and it's hard, because I still want to take care of myself, because I'm still presumptuous and I still think I know what's best. He also didn't concern himself with what others would think about him. I touched on this last time when we went through this, but the cultural issues behind what was going on here, I mean, we can understand it from a certain degree, where it would be a little bit surprising if the father ran out to the son and that sort of thing, but maybe not a little bit, because we watch a lot of Hollywood movies and happy endings happen all the time, so we kind of expect them. But understand, culturally, when Jesus is telling this parable, the expectation of everyone around it is that boy is going to get shunned. That boy is never going to ever going to be really a part of the family again. That if the best thing that boy can hope for is, like that boy had thought, that he might end up being a slave for the rest of his life. But he was on the outs, and the father was going to hold it against him. And it was the father's job to do so. To be a fine, upstanding part of society, the father's response should have been to punish that boy for the rest of his life. But the father was not concerned. He wasn't concerned about how he looked to others. He was willing to look foolish. 1 Corinthians 1:18, "For the word of the cross is folly to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved is the power of God." 1 Corinthians 2:14, "The natural person does not accept the things of the Spirit of God, for they are folly to him, and he is not able to understand them because they are spiritually discerned." This is not simply being willing to do. What I'm saying here is, this is more than just simply being willing to do things that might upset people. That's hard enough, granted, or put people off. But even more than that, we should beg God and seek to be as selfless as He was and is, that we are willing to sacrifice our reputation in order to love others. That we are willing to have people around us look at us and go, "You're an idiot." Or, "How can you possibly allow that to go on? How can you possibly do that? You've got it all wrong." Be willing to be misunderstood and ridiculed for it. Because here's the thing. This is the essence of the issue that Christ had with the Pharisees. This is the whole point. This is actually why he's telling the parable. Why? The Pharisees are what? Telling Jesus he's illegitimate, because why? He's loving sinners. And he looked foolish. He had no reputation whatsoever, no standing. They ridiculed him and mocked him. His only thoughts were for the boy. And the boy was never far from his heart. We see that because, again, he was a long way off when he saw him. His hope wasn't placed in the child. Knowing his nature, he would have understood that the kid wasn't capable of coming to his senses on his own. And if that were the case, that he had somehow hoped, if he had somehow placed his hope only in the boy, and his hope was not placed in God and his sovereignty, you think the father at some point would have given up looking, right? I mean, if he's just putting his hope in the boy, after a while, he's not coming back. It's not happening. But his hope wasn't found in that relationship with that child, and his hope that the child's return wasn't placed in the child either. It was placed in who? God. He didn't, and again, like I mentioned before, he did not wait to see or hear what the boy said before he moved towards him and welcoming him home. What allowed him to go to the boy is also what provided him the hope that the boy was not gone for good. God's sovereign control over the human heart. Proverbs 15:11, Sheol and Abaddon lie open before the Lord. How much more the hearts of the children of men? Don't worry. Cast your cares on Him. He cares for you. Psalm 55:22, cast your burdens on the Lord. He will sustain you. He will never permit the righteous to be moved. Psalm 68:19, blessed be the Lord who daily bears us up. God is our salvation. That's where the Father's hope was. He had to be quite settled on what he believed and who he believed in to restrain himself from trying to go and find the boy or to manipulate the situation or try to somehow, I mean, just to keep himself restrained and not to somehow manipulate the situation on his own. To not to go try to find him or to let him go in the first place. But what we see in the Father is what Jesus explains to us in Matthew 7:24-27, everyone then who hears these words of mine and does them will be like a wise man who built his house on the rock. The rain fell and the floods came and the winds blew and beat on that house, but it did not fall because it had been founded on the rock. And everyone who hears these words of mine and does not do them is like the foolish man who built his house on the sand. The rain fell, the floods came, the wind blew and beat against the house, and it fell, and great was its fall. Father was meek and he was selfless. He was not concerned with himself at any point. Quickly, I'm going to draw a few things from the older brother. Many different lessons we can pull, but one of the first things we see about the older brother is he was self-absorbed. Just like his younger son or younger brother, the younger son, when he left, there was that boy was self-absorbed. This older boy is pretty self-absorbed too. How do we know that? Because he became angry. And from the outside perspective, his anger seems justifiable, right? Well, his dad just let the prodigal back in and gave him, you know, giving him clothes and having a party and throwing, you know, the guy just went and wasted all this money and we're celebrating him. Seems pretty ridiculous. But it's self-righteous indignation. He gives himself away. He became angry. Why? Anger seems justified and understandable, but it's self-righteous in its indignation. The sum of our works mean nothing when we view it with the proper view of reality. Again, referencing Philippians 2:3. Anger is always a response, or anger is, I would say, 99.9% of the time in my life, a response to the violation of pride or justice, what I think is fair and right. And it was a not-so-subtle rejection of authority. Was it not? In this case, it's a rejection of the authority of the Father. You did this, I don't like it. I think it's wrong. So what makes me angry? When I find myself angered or tempted to respond in anger, what is it that I didn't get? What is it I believe I should have had that I didn't? Or what should have happened that didn't happen? Are my expectations that I had biblical when I found myself responding in anger? Again, what would the older son's expectation and the cultural expectation was the younger boy gets shamed, shunned, cut off, treated like garbage the rest of his life. And not welcomed and celebrated. I would just encourage you all, and for me, as a point of a confession, and and asking you all for encouragement, that I struggle mightily with this so many times in my life, especially in my parenting, and responding in anger. Again, you can think of already telling you that I wrestle so desperately with trying to find little bits of free time in my own life. Who is it that usually violates that? The four little me's running around. But if I confess my anger and I root out its cause in my life and I see that as an opportunity to do that, then I'm bringing myself under more subjection to authority when I do that. Instead of simply recognizing anger, saying it's wrong, confession demands that we turn from it. And to turn from it, we need to take the opportunity to see what was it that we didn't get that we wanted, and how is that not biblical? And how should I think differently? Confess anger, root out its causes in your life, and use it as an opportunity to find areas that haven't been brought into subjection yet. That's what anger is. In a very real way, anger is a great thing to pay attention to, because it's showing you immediately, here's an area of your life not subjected to the authority of God. He's also void of love for his brother or his father. Why? Because he refuses to go in. He doesn't rejoice with those who rejoice. He doesn't weep with those who weep. He is not concerned with what the father finds to be exciting or enjoyable, and he certainly isn't concerned about his brother at all, because he doesn't even want to go see him. Love is self-last mindset. The boy was bitter. This boy was bitter. Guard against fear. Guard and fear. Fear a bitter attitude toward anyone. Hebrews 12:15. See to it that no one fails to obtain the grace of God, that no root of bitterness springs up and causes trouble, and by it many become defiled. Anger and resentment that are allowed to fester grow into bitterness. Bitterness will divide and isolate you. When we see sin, we have to deal with it immediately. If it's sin against you, you're called to admonish and do the things that you're supposed to do. Allowing that not to be dealt with, that festers and grows and can grow into bitterness and will divide you and will separate you. And the same when you see it in your own heart, confess and deal with sin. Avoid, battle, fight, run from bitterness. Be bold and courageous. Because again, we've already discussed and talked about admonishment, encouragement, those things, those real important parts of body life are messy and gross and weird and fraught with misunderstanding and fraught with pain and suffering and the possibility of being misperceived or misunderstood. But they're right and they're good. He was void of love for his brother. He was actually bitter. He was self-absorbed. He was bitter. And he was a rule follower, right? He says, I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders. Busyness and effort are always only an effect. It is the cause or the motivation of the busyness that matters. The father never disputes the boy's claim to have been faithful in following his commands. What is exposed in this moment, however, is that the motivation or cause for the boy's obedience had everything to do with him and what he could gain out of it. The boy wasn't working for the father. The boy wasn't interested in how it reflected on the father that he was obedient. The boy didn't care about anything other than that obedience got him what he wanted or was putting him in position to find the things that he wanted. He was self-absorbed. He was entitled. He wasn't working for the benefit of his father, was he? He didn't really care. Godly obedience does what is asked because of what has already been gained. Romans 12:1, it's our reasonable service. Even what the boy says, make me like your hired servant. That's all I'm asking. Are we obedient because of what has been done for us, or what we hope will be done for us or to us? And are we faithful when it'll cost us? When it puts us at a disadvantage, are we willing to be obedient when it puts us at a disadvantage, or when it will expose us or could make us look foolish and weak? Both the father and the younger son look this way, right? The father looks foolish and weak because he allows the son to come back. The son looks foolish and weak because he came back. They're the celebrated ones in this. The one that's the strong, austere, you know, got it together guy. He's the bad guy in the parable. I hate to tell you. Consider the pronouns in verse 29. The older brother had been serving not his father but himself the whole time. Subtle and dangerous because it's from the outside. It's subtle and dangerous because from the outside it appears what? The boy's got it together. The boy, that's the one you want to be like. He was the model son and the one that was close to salvation. The same entitlement that was expressed by the younger son is expressed by the older one, but in a different way, right? He says, "You never even gave me a goat." What's behind that? I deserve a goat. Actually, I deserve a lot more than a goat. Look what everything I've been doing for you. Again, entitlement is a human condition. The implication is that it was expected and even right based upon everything he'd done. It was owed to him. Remember, God has chosen to save weak and foolish people. He isn't about polish and effort. He is about humility, honesty, and meekness. Mark 2:17, and when Jesus heard it, he said to them, "Those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick, I came not to call righteous, but sinners." We're sinners. I'm a sinner. I'm a big, fat, smelly sinner. I'm terrible at a lot of things. I get angry all the time. I'm unkind. My speech is terrible. I used to be warming my car up in the driveway for a long time. Did all kinds of crazy stuff. I'm a sinner, y'all, and I make mistakes. But God has chosen to save me. I don't know why. He's chosen to save you, and He's called us to live one another and encourage one another as we journey towards home. I mean, think Isaiah 53:2. He grew up before him like a young plant and like a root out of dry ground. He had no form or majesty that we should look at him, and no beauty that we should desire him. That's who Christ was. He wasn't polished. He wasn't together. He was from the backwater town of Nazareth. He was an illegitimate son of Mary, who no one really knows who the father is. I mean, that's who he was. He had nothing. He wasn't polished. We shouldn't be afraid of these things in ourselves, nor should we shy away of them, nor should we shy away from others who are in this state. The sinner is messy, exposed, vulnerable, and makes those who come to their aid vulnerable as well. Again, that dad took off running to that boy before he had any idea what was actually happening. There's a whole mess of trouble there if that boy had sorted himself out. Dad didn't care. He was gone. It's comfortable to maintain polish. It's comfortable to maintain polish and find other polished people, but it isn't biblical. Let's pray. God, thank you for this parable. Thank you for the words of Scripture. Thank you that you love us perfectly. God, forgive us for being the younger son and the older son. Forgive us for those things. Help us to be like you. Help us to love one another. Help us to love our neighbors. Help us to be obedient, to shine the glory and the majesty of you to the world around us. In your name I pray. Amen.